This is Barrett Edelstein from Celeb Savant, and today we are speaking to Greg Kane from Hue and Cry. Greg, where do we find you in the world? What are you up to? How's life going? And how are things in your world?
I'm coming. Oh, hello. Thank you for having me, first of all. But I'm coming from Pat and I's own studio in Glasgow, in Scotland, in the UK. You find me good. As I said to you in the pre-show, I've just upgraded all my computer systems, which sounds easy, but in practice, it's quite tough. I'm now sort of trying to figure out. I think Apple computers give you a migration assistant, but I don't want half of the junk that's on the old thing, so I'm just going to do a clean install, but I need to find logins and passwords. I mean, ugh. My brother Pat has gone on holiday for 2 weeks, so I left it up until now to do this. I should have maybe booked a holiday myself, but there you go.
So let's take it now all the way back to the beginning. Tell us about the Hue and Cry story. First of all, where does the name come from? And your origins through the 80s and the whole story. Let's start from the beginning.
Well, Hue and Cry are two brothers. Pat, the older brother, sings. I'm the younger brother, Greg. I play all the music and produce all the records. And there's 3 years between us. So Pat and I were at the same school. I was always involved in music, played piano since I was 9, played saxophone since I was 13. But Pat was more sort of interested in theatre and musical theatre, and he was always in the theatre productions at school. And then I was in a band when I was 15, 16 years old called The Winning Losers. And our singer left because he was a bit disenchanted with the music business, even though we were still at school. Thought it was a bit of a prima donna of him. But anyway, I suggested that my older brother would step in. And the guys in the band were a bit kind of, what, the guy that does all the musical theatre stuff? I said, yes, that's him. He went, well, we're supposed to be a punk band. I said, well, you know, Pat's a bit as punk as you can get. So we tried him out, and it worked really well. And those early demos of The Winning Losers, you're talking about 1981, 82, were played on local radio and got some traction. And then the band threw us out because they didn't like the way the music was going. And then Pat and I found ourselves on our own. But I think what had happened was the band had given us a platform to figure out how we could work together, because we'd never really worked together musically. So in hindsight, the band throwing us out was probably the best thing for us. And we kind of used the band. It wasn't the reason we joined the band, but in hindsight, when you think about it, the band were useful to us because, as I said, they taught Pat and I how to work together. So we demoed all the way through 84, 85, and the local studio we were using at the time in Glasgow, the guy who owned the studio, who was making the demos for us, one time he came in and he said, if you let me manage you, you don't have to pay for these demos. So at the time, Pat and I had to stump up £50 each to pay for these demos. So it was quite good to put £50 back in your pocket. And we went home, told my father. He said, you didn't sign anything, did you? And we said, no. And that manager, Alan McNeil, was our manager from 1985 until 1992, and we never signed anything with him, and we had an amazing working relationship. So he was the guy that put our recordings in front of people that maybe would be interested. And there's a very famous club in Glasgow called the Sub Club, celebrating its 35th year this year, actually, and it's about to be appointed a cultural icon in Scotland, the Sub Club. People will know it's a big dance club. But the guy that ran it at the time was interested in Pat and I, and he had his own indie record label, and he put out a song called Here Comes Everybody in 1984. And it was, it sold out its whole 1,000 run. It was only 1,000 12 inches made, and it started to get played on radio, and it started to feature on dance floors in London. And the two guys from Circa Records came up to see us and figure out what it was all about. And they quite liked the dance record that we put out on this label. But when Pat and I started to sing piano vocal during the show and just do more kind of melancholy, kind of introspective stuff, that's what got them interested. So these two guys had worked with Bob Marley, U2, Island Records. That's where they came from. So all that sort of stuff was going on. And they'd left Island Records to form their own thing. And we were the first band that they signed. And then they went on to sign Massive Attack and Nena Cherry and all that sort of stuff. So that's basically as condensed as I can make it back.
And tell me, where does the name Hue and Cry come from?
Well, Pat's my older brother, who's the singer, is the kind of wordsmith between us. And he came home one day and said, I've got an idea for a name. And he said, Hue and Cry. And I was the same as you. What does that mean? And he said, well, it literally means a loud public commotion. So that's kind of what we hope to make. And there was the duality of the Hue and Cry. He was the cry, the voice, and I was the Hue, the background. And there was a famous Ealing comedy called The Hue and Cry, and it's about brothers. And so it all seemed to fit. And nobody else had never heard the name before. So it's quite good to come up with a name of a band that's memorable and unique. So we were very lucky.
Tell me, what is your music creation process? Is it still the same today as it was then? How do you create music? What is that flow? How do we get to hear the end result?
Pat and I are big fans of the song. So we're big fans of verse, bridge, chorus. And we'll go into a room with a piano with a blank sheet of paper from both of us, and we won't leave the room until we've got a verse, a chorus, and a verse, and a chorus. We won't leave the room unless we can go leave the room, go to an open stage and play the song we've just written. So we don't leave anything unfinished. It will be further developed, but we can't really leave anything unfinished. It's always the way we've done it. And then back then, you just record it in a dictaphone, I guess, and I'd write down the chords. Pat likes complex things, so I can't just sit down at a piano and play G, C, and D. He won't even look at me if I present him that. So it has to be a bit more complex than that. So it was quite difficult for me to remember what I was doing with these songs, and it still is sometimes. I've got my own way of writing the chords down. Sometimes when I show my band, they say, Greg, let me see your music, and they just look at it like it's some kind of Greek or Egyptian hieroglyphics. They think, I don't understand it. Think about that, but I have my own notation way of remembering the way I'm voicing it, rather than just write it down. I can read music, and I've always been able to read music, but for some reason this way of me remembering chords has kind of evolved through the years. So put Pat and I in a room with a piano, and either 15 minutes later or 4 hours later we'll emerge with a completed song. So that's the way we do it. And then, you know, it depends what we want to do with the song, and then we can just get creative with how we want to produce it. So it's very collaborative and very start with a blank sheet of paper and, as I say, come out the room with something that's a song.
Do you guys ever disagree about what that end result's going to be?
It's very interesting. Pat and I, it's a lot of it's about body language. So we're in the room. If I'm presenting him with a chord sequence and I can tell by his body language if it's good or not for him, if I'm pushing a chord progression that I particularly think is good, if he doesn't engage with it after about a minute or a minute and a half, i.e. he doesn't change the melody to fit it, that's him saying to me, no, Greg. He won't stop me and say no, but I can tell from the way he reacts to what I play. And body language is very important for Pat and I. I mean, you need to be very careful when you're doing a writing process, when you're in the writing process with Pat and I, because it's very subtle, some of the things that we do to each other. We don't write very well with other people because we don't have that intimacy, and that has a lot to do with what we are, and because we're brothers. And I guess a lot of the people that like our music and come to see us, mostly when we sit and play on our own, they celebrate and they love watching two brothers being very intimate. We're very lucky that brothers are very rarely intimate. My friends see their siblings at Christmas and at funerals and weddings. I see my brother every single weekend.
And what inspires your music lyrics? Is it personal experience, things that are happening around the world, combination of both? What are those words and how do they come from?
I think it's a combination of both, but it's mostly our personal opinion of what's happening around us. I mean, the first big hit we had, Labour Love, 1987, was it was all very political. We had a right-wing government that Scotland hadn't voted for, and the song was all about trying to come to terms with working-class people voting for a government that doesn't really care about them. All it cares about is big business and money and free market economy. And we couldn't understand why working class people would vote for that, but they did. So the song was all about us trying to deal with understanding that. And then the other, Looking for Linda, is a song about domestic abuse. But that Pat actually met the girl and she told him the story of what happened to her. So that's a personal experience, but how you feel personally about a more general topic. That's the kind of the way we write the songs.
COVID, everyone was in lockdown. Everyone was shut down. How did you guys deal with COVID? What did you get to in your world? And did you carry on creating music? What happened in your space?
Well, we had quite an interesting COVID. I have older in-laws, parents, and a partner who was in the vulnerable category, Pat's partner as well. So we were adhering to the lockdowns and the isolations quite strictly because we couldn't afford anything to happen to these people that mean so much to us. But just before COVID hit, Pat and I finished writing about 18 songs for a new record. So I said, well, I've got my studio here. I'm the only one that's here. It's not a commercial studio. It's just my place or Pat and I's place. So I'll just finish the record. I'll just do the record. The songs are all written. If I need you to sing, then we can do it somehow. But I've got all the guide vocals. I've got all the arrangements. So I had a plan and I thought this is going to be great. But it didn't turn out that way, Barry. It turned out terrible for me creatively. We had all these songs and I could not figure out what to do with them. And I thought in isolation, when I go and make music and produce music, it's usually in isolation. So I thought there would be no difference. But there was a huge difference mm-hmm. because without the socialising, not that I'm a big socialiser, but because I work on my own an awful lot, the times that I go out to meet friends and just experience social gatherings, I realised how important it was to me. So the whole isolation, working on my own during COVID, didn't work. And my management company and my brother were getting frustrated at me, but I had to fess up and say, I don't know if it's a little bit of depression, I don't know what's going on, but I really cannot focus. And we built a fantastic studio here. I can do anything I want in this place, but I didn't want to do anything.
Yeah.
So a lot of bands were doing online YouTube performances and they were just trying to keep their fans engaged. We went down a different route. We wanted to do concerts that you had to pay for. So we wanted to put online concerts behind a paywall. Now, everybody knows putting content behind a paywall is incredibly difficult. So we found a guy called Steve Mackin, and he's got a company called livefrom.events. And Steve, his mantra is he loves to sell tickets. He'll sell raffle tickets. He'll sell gig tickets. He just loves tickets. That's his thing. I spoke to him.
Okay.
And he said, don't worry, Greg, we'll make this work. So we broadcast 4 concerts on this platform, and they were incredibly successful. We'd, I think, 900 to 1,000 people were logging in, paying £10 to come and see us. And they would, nothing ever went wrong. I got all the engineers to hardwire this whole place, and we had an incredible experience doing these concerts. They weren't like back-to-back. We do one concert, then wait 3 months, and then do another concert, wait 3 months, and did it that way. But we were out touring. We're out gigging just now. Pat mentions from the stage that anybody see these online performances. And there's quite a lot of people that shout, wave their hands, say yes. So our fans have always embraced a new technology, even though they're mostly late 30s to late 50s. But Pat and I have always, even pre-Facebook, we've built online environments for Hue and Cry fans to come and just hang out, talk to Pat and I, interact with Pat and I. We had that way before Facebook, so we were always involved in that, but we'd never done a paywall before. It always been a sort of promotion type thing just to keep people engaged with what Pat and I do. But it was very successful for us. And then that meant Pat had to come up from London to Glasgow to the studio. That was quite difficult because the first twice I went down to get him and we drove up together in the car. It's a long drive. It's 400 miles there and back. But I suppose in South Africa, that's nothing to you guys, is it? It's like, no, that's not very far away at all. But for us, it is. But that was just to keep our bubble. And we kept our bubble when he was here. And then went back down to London again. And we were totally testing all the way through it. So it was a mixed bag during COVID. Creatively, these concerts were fantastic. Creatively, trying to make a new record that we'd written before COVID was a nightmare for me. And only now am I, that's why all these new computers have been bought to try and finish this record. But I mean, that was, I felt it was a wasted 2 years. But no, I couldn't do it. But I just didn't have the space to do it in my head. I didn't know what was wrong. And I watched other bands release records during COVID. I think Mogwai, the other Scottish band, they were quite successful. But then I watched Amy McDonald kind of not be successful with it. And I watched Delamitri, just friends of ours, not be successful with it. So it was a bit, in a way, I'm glad we didn't release the record. I didn't finish the record and release it during COVID, because if you can't gig and tour and promote a record, it'll just disappear. It won't have any legs. Yep. You know what I mean? So yes, very frustrating generally.
But don't you think that even though it was frustrating, that if you would have pushed through and tried to achieve it and tried to go ignore that part of you saying no, it wouldn't have been as authentic and organic and true to who you guys were, because there was something there stopping you. So naturally you had to listen to that.
Yeah, I mean, I fought it so many times and I didn't know what to do. And I spoke to a lot of people about it and they said, well, is it a writer's block? I said, no, I'll sit and write your song right now if you want. It was just getting... Yeah, you can write as many songs as you want, and there's an old jazz adage which says you can play any song any way. So when you've got a song that's written, you're trying to create a vehicle for it, i.e. make the record. And I've never had any problems with that. I mean, it's never been a bother for me. I love being creative, and I love you can be as odd as you want, but you've obviously got an eye on commercialism. You've got an eye on the platforms that this music will be consumed on, like radio and podcasts and clubs and stuff like that. You have to keep an eye on that. And then mostly, we do a lot of big festivals now, these 80s festivals, and there's 20,000 people out there in front of you in this huge stage. So you have to think about the song in that environment. How's it going to project? So I've got all these mechanisms and ways of doing it that I've been done my whole career, but I couldn't seem to muster them and focus them. I'm talking to you now and I'm thinking, why didn't I do that? Why didn't I just imagine these songs on a big stage and make them that way? So it wasn't really the writing of the songs. There's some great songs in there. I'm so proud of us. It was the creating the record that was a problem for me.
You know, it was probably the energy block, because everything was literally, figuratively, and energetically shut down completely. So that energetically element or energy element is a way that you translate into the production. And because that was shut down, it affected you, which makes sense. It affected everyone in different ways. So it was just a way of accepting it, acknowledging it, and saying, okay, it's here. Let's just accept it, feel it, and then move beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, Pat and I are both big fans of Prince, and I've studied Prince quite a lot of detail, and he would go into the studio and not appear for weeks until he would appear with 1999 or like Sign of the Times, or you know, he would. But I used to think, well, how can I can channel that energy of just shutting everything off? My partner and my kids were prepared to go, right, just go and do what you need to do. But then again, when I tried that, 3 days later I would reappear going, I'm kind of missing everybody. I'm a bit lonely. But I've suffered from loneliness in my life before. But there definitely was a big sense of loneliness. And but you're right, the energy was not around me or surrounding me. I found it difficult to do it. So yeah, frustrating, as I say.
So we are looking forward to hearing the new songs and new album come out. You must definitely keep us updated and posted. Yes. I'm definitely looking forward to that. Now, speaking of music, music was vinyl, cassettes, CDs, they are now coming back into the world. Those, you know, the aesthetics of holding something is coming back. But music is consumed more in the digital world on those platforms. What is your perception of these platforms and the way the listening audience is now interacting and engaging with music?
It's an interesting question, but I've got an 18-year-old stepson. So he was 18 about 2 months ago. And he said to his, Mum and I said to him, you know, what do you want for your 18th? And he said, a record player. I said, what, you mean a vinyl record player? Uh-huh. You haven't got any records, but I want a vinyl. Okay. So we bought them. Nothing spent 200 quid on a really nice one from, I can't remember the name of it. And his mum and I went to a second-hand Oxfam store. The record store's a famous one in Byers Road in Glasgow. And we bought them the best of ABBA, the best of the Carpenters, you know, Bon Jovi.
Yes.
Hue and Cry. I could give them some Hue and Cry. And then Curiosity Killed the Cat, Go West, Elton John, Phil Collins, George Michael, all these classic 80s, 90s artists. And he absolutely loves it. He loves it. And I'm thinking, and he's going to university this year. And I said, are you taking your record player with me? He says, oh, yeah. So I'm thinking, I'm scratching my head because it used to frustrate the hell out of me, a record player, but he's 18 years old. And then I concur with what Jack Black was saying a few months ago, where he made the plea to the major record companies, please open your own pressing plants. Because every time an Adele record or an Ed Sheeran record comes out, they completely take over all the pressing plants. Nobody else can get their records pressed. I do a lot of restoration work for like old soul record labels, and they buy old soul recordings. They come to me, I digitize them, restore them, take all the crackles and all the crap out of them, and then they re-release them. So their lead time now is 10 months. It's 10 months.
Oh,
if I hand you a recording to a pressing plant and it's 10 months later, I'll get my record. So it's definitely really popular again. I'm not in that space. My son is. My partner is. We moved into our new home. She got the listening room sorted out with her Pioneer turntable and her speakers. And really, and she stuck on the doors and told me to get out of the house and sat and listened to the doors. You know what I mean? It's like, so there must be some.
That's so funny. For me, I've got the Hue and Cry CDs. I've got them in my collection, and I still love buying the CDs. I love that action of opening the booklets and, you know, holding something. And I love that. And that's why when you're talking about your stepson wanting the vinyl, the record player, and him loving it, I got warm and fuzzy all over because I was like, yes, it's still there and it will carry on being there.
I mean, I think so. I mean, what the new business model for bands is, you know, I was talking about Mogwai earlier on, the Scottish band that I know quite well. They had a number one record in the UK a few months back. And I said to Stuart, when I met him in the pub, when I congratulated him, and I said, Stuart, if you don't mind me, how many records did you actually sell? And he said, 19,000. And I said, you know what? Labour Love was number six, didn't even get to number one, and it sold nearly 400,000. So it's a completely different playing field now. But our mantra was always, if you can find 1,000 fans that can spend £100 a year, then that's enough to make a living. And £100 a year is maybe a couple of gigs, a T-shirt, or maybe a vinyl or a CD. You don't need hundreds of thousands and millions of fans to be a successful musician nowadays. So what they call it is you supersell your super fans and they'll be more than happy to give you the money. So that's the situation that Pat and I find ourselves in. It's a bit more than 1,000, but you just concentrate on the people that are eager to get involved in you and your music. And if other people jump on board, then that's great. Our social media followers and people has never stopped rising since we started doing this in the mid-2000s. So it's a whole different landscape. And if you want to consume your music via your phone or a record player or a CD player or going to a gig, that's your choice.
As the last two more questions, the first one is, I'm going to be putting you on the spot right now.
Uh-huh.
And that question is, of other artists, what is your top five songs, just off the top of your mind, your five favorite songs from five to number one? What are those songs by which artists? I'm putting you on the spot, though.
All right, five to number one.
Yes.
Definitely Mountains by Prince from his Parade album.
Yes.
Papa's Got a Brand New Bag by James Brown. Anything off Talking Book by Stevie Wonder. What else would I be listening to? I need to think of a ballad then, won't I? I love Fix You by Coldplay. It's a beautiful song. Love
yes, it. That is beautiful, yeah.
And, High and Dry from the Bends, Radiohead.
Brilliant. Brilliant five songs. Love it. As our podcast and our show is listened and viewed all around the world, what is your final message to our listening audience?
The 57 million people that listen to all your podcasts. What a fabulous,
what a fabulous
group of people.
Putting it out there that they all will be. So what's your final message to them?
Well, just we need to learn to get on with each other better. And if we all try that, then I think the world will be a much better place.
Love it. Perfect. This is Celeb Savant signing out with the brilliant Greg Crane from Hue and Cry. Thank you so much, Greg.
Thanks, Barrett.